The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. I just realized this is my first talk in this Zendo for a couple years, so it's nice to be back. So I've been working on this all week, and actually for a long time, wanting to express something about what I'll bring up today. And I have this little book of the Dhammapada. Some of you may have it, the sayings of the Buddha, which I like to read before I go to bed, just drop in some of Buddha's words. And I landed on this one because of what was in me. Gentle sages, go to the unwavering state where, having gone, there's no grief. So that's the main case. Shagbar, who is a Tibetan teacher, said, sadness rages like a fire, though in mind there is no wood. A storm of tears pours down ceaselessly, though in the sky of my eyes there are no clouds. So I wanted to speak about grief. We have all cried, and some of us more than others. And I'm not here to divide us into leaders of tears that we've cried, rather to unite us, because we all have grieving. And we do feel sad, stressed, overwhelmed, scared, and frustrated at times, and hold on to grief. And we have lots of other feelings at the same time. So, what is grief? And can we respect it? And actually, it's in the 12 links. It comes under the last link of suffering, the mass of suffering that the Buddha said we have, grief, death. And also, as we talk about karma, suffering helps karma shift. When we use our suffering well, it helps karma shift. But can we respect this feeling and not fear it? And what are the ways that the Dharma and other practices can help us work in and through our embodiment of grief and its raw ingredients? One of our Sufi relatives says, one should never be embittered at the amount of suffering one is entrusted with. Entrusted with. So, grief is not a thing. There are no things. Or even a feeling. It's a process. A continuum of emotions that unfolds at its own pace. And we don't get to know in advance how much time it will take or how it will unfold. And no one can tell us. It has its own path. I kind of called this good grief when it's used well. It's good grief. Like, good grief. We can say that to ourselves, good grief. Yeah, good grief. So we can feel it. Buddha taught, I was wondering what the Buddha and wisdom teachings taught about grief. And as I said, Buddha taught that grief is a form of dukkha. Dukkha means suffering, which often arises out of our attachment to either impermanent pleasures, And yesterday, Roshi said in a retreat, dukkha is about power, to want to control or stay away from our pain. So it's when we can't have those pleasures, and it's when we want to control and not feel and have pain. And that's where we vacillate mostly. That's called suffering, right? And just like we're presented with in our Buddhist practice, we have a choice to be present with what is in each moment. But how common it is when we feel grief that we quickly want to move out of it or lay something intellectual on it. Well, everything's impermanent, something like that. Transcend through our intellect. Go to the truth of impermanence. That's just our super ego voice. Just let go. I mean, it's helpful, but we have to let in before we let go. I mean, what are we holding? How do you let go of what you don't even know you're like holding onto or seeing? So letting in to see that there's actually nothing to let go of, but just a process to move through. So I think I started this process, over 5 or 6 years ago when I got hit hard with something that took me to my knees, to this earth. Just, you know, death. And I kept seeing myself going in and out of this tangled web of why? Such a hard, endless question. Why? Why do I have to suffer like this? Why can't I get over this? Why did this happen to me? Why did they do this? And I was just like, no more. That's not the right question. It's just so. It's just here. So, most often we can't even find the reasons or words to make sense of our sadness. And I began to call it a season. It's just a season I'm in. It's just so. It's just such. Of course, we know Buddha has experienced grief or loss. He had, you can look at his life and his pleasures and how that, when he saw old age, sickness, and death, what that did to him. And then he, as he developed his teachings, he said, I only teach one thing. So in all these volumes of Buddhist stuff, he says, all I teach is suffering and how to put an end to suffering. That's it. Every teaching is about that, to understand ourselves and how to put an end to suffering in ourself and in the world. And so I looked in the Pali Canon, teachings of the Buddha, read endless books on grief, sorrow, like up to here, still have a big stack, stories from people, personal experiences shared on grief and sorrow, went to workshops, meetings, witches, masseuses, watched countless talks and videos, how people in this and other cultures don't share grief, do share grief, celebrate it, hide it, are ashamed of it, have dealt with it together and alone, has both of those aspects. I've witnessed animals' loss of partners, children crying out in anguish, experienced the loss of trust in community with spiritual teachers, that kind of loss. So it's something we need to acknowledge. We all have it, whether we let it in or not. And to make good use of our good grief and suffering. And doing it, naming it, saying it, acknowledging it, helps us to, I think, soften the sense of being utterly and brutally alone. So this is kind of a ceremony of letting in. We would have to be in a very deep fog to not be touched by grief. And you know, everyone, no one gets liberated without liberating everyone else a bit, really. I mean, we're on a seriously warming planet by our own doing, within the coronavirus pandemic still going. Over 5 million people have lost their life, have died. And we're also living in a pandemic of grief and hatred underlying the virus. Every morning we wake up from our dream world into another dream, this dream. We're dreaming this together. And after a minute we realize that something has died. It's something in the world as we know it. Often there, as I said, there may be no words, just it comes as like a sinking feeling in the gut. Like life itself is being threatened by our very breathing. But we have to continue to breathe to live. And we yearn each day for the nectars of sounds, smells, tastes, sights of life that we're used to. And we also may be heavy with grieving and losses and the rising hatred in that mix. So utterly trying to get into balance, because there is balance, there is harmony, that is true. I could go on and on, I have a whole litany, I think I'll stop there, but we get the point. We already know what is in front of us, but at the same time, what is occurring in the world is unknown. So what is being asked of us? What is asked for us to be discovering? So when grief shatters all we have known or hold dear, if we can let the letting of shattering happen, a great expansion happens. And those of you that have done that know that expansion. At the very same time you're letting in, it gets larger. We get larger. And it's the beginning of an experience much larger than anything that feels like broken, because we're not. Can we grieve mindfully? Yes. Yes, we can. Without going into suppression, bypassing, intellectualization, religious dogma, you know, dumping some sutra on top of our feelings. It could help if we use it right, but not to bypass. Yes. Though we can feel, I think, the pulls and tendency to do exactly that, suppress, bypass. It's scary what might happen. And then we get these phrases like, I'm not supposed to, I don't want to look like. And actually, we might get to the point where we don't even have enough strength to muster the veil, nor the desire any longer to maintain protection. And that's when we can break open in that letting in. It's amazing. It's amazing to let that happen. And in that the deepest grief, we find our true refuge right there. We find faith in our heart and mind right there, letting it all shatter, sink us, take us to our knees, to the earth, before we can re-emerge and move to a point of acceptance. It takes time. We don't accept right away. We have to go through a process. And right there, in that moment, we can get the glimpse of the possibility of the joyful, happier person at the very same time that we're imploding. How does that happen? It does, right? You know it. Some of you, right? It's like at the same time, you know it's so true that this honesty, this raw honesty with what's happening, we find our joy because we're not blocking it. We're not blocking the energy. We're respecting our energetic body, our soma. And so when I looked for Buddhist teachings on how to deal and heal the wounds of grief, mostly I found as the Buddha likes, steps. Steps in mental training that leads from acceptance of loss all the way to the total release from grief and the pains along with us, which I won't lay out, but you can look for that. All this mental training that we have, actually. But sometimes there's other things needed along with our practice of mental training, like going outside, talking to birds and trees, looking at the river and the sky, and the moonlight, to touch our generativity. These are ancient practices that we have forgotten. These are from our ancestors. Go look at the sky. Go feel the wind. Go let the rain touch your cheeks and get you wet and saturated. So healing, right? So healing and regenerative. The arts, poetry, painting, singing, dancing, music. I use all of these to attend to the grief. So I turn to some of our women ancestors, which I know this process of grieving. You can read their stories in the Theragata. It's mostly what they speak about. And this is Ubiri's story, one of the first women who was with the Buddha, and these poems, the Theragata, are the realization poems of the women at the Buddha's time. They're great, the Theragata. And so she was drowning in grief at the death of her daughter. And she was from a high family in Savatthi. And she was a beautiful child. And when she grew up, was given to the court of King Pasanadi of Kosala. And she became pregnant by the king. Okay, we'll just let that story go. And gave birth to a daughter whom she named Jiva, which means alive. Jiva, alive. And shortly after being born, Jiva died. Ubiri, as we can imagine, was consumed by grief. And she kept going to the cremation ground to mourn her daughter. And one day she arrived and there was a group of people gathered. And she heard that the Buddha was going to be there. He was traveling through and was going to give a teaching to the local people. And she stopped for a while to listen to the Buddha. And then she left and went to the riverside and just started weeping again in despair. And Buddha heard her. After he finished his talk, he heard her down by the river wailing, howling. And he called out and said, "How come you're weeping?" And in agony, she cried out, "Because my daughter has died." And then Buddha then pointed to one place and to another, because they're in their cremation field. And all the dead had been laid out and called to her, "Mother, you cry out, O Jiva in the wood. Come to your senses, Ubiri. 84,000 daughters, all named Jiva, have been burned in that charnel ground. For which one of them do you grieve? For which one of them do you grieve? For which one of them do you grieve?" So, this sorrow of great and small losses is a river that runs underground our lives. And when it breaks to the surface, we often feel like we're the only one sometimes. Yet we know it's everywhere and in everyone. We should reflect on that. It's helpful to know that the universe isn't focusing unusual punishment on us in particular, right? It helps. When the 18th century Zen master Issa lost his baby daughter, he wrote, "The dewdrop world is the dewdrop world. And yet, the dewdrop world is the dewdrop world. And yet. So he's talking about this absolute world, and yet, here we are in this relative world with each other. And yet. He has not yet been released by the anguish of grief, but the hand is beginning to open, like the transiency of his precious daughter's life. His grief may too pass. And this is a most beautiful koan I'll shift to from The Hidden Lamp, which is the stories from 25 centuries of awakened women, which is called Satchujo Weeps. Here's the koan. When Satchujo, a disciple of Hakuin, who was a very famous Rinzai Zen master, she was the disciple of him, was old, she lost her granddaughter, which grieved her very much. An old man from the neighborhood came and admonished her, "Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll say, the old lady who once studied with Hakuin was enlightened, so why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up a bit." Satchujo glared at her neighbor and scolded him, "You bald-headed fool, what do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than incense, flowers, and lamps." The old man left without a word. So how does that strike you? It's said that she was maybe a niece of Hakuin and a Zen adept at a very early age. And her awakening was recognized by Hakuin. And she's known for defeating others in a Dharma encounter, including on occasion Hakuin himself. And I wanted to give you another one of her encounters so you can get a sense of her rebel feistiness. You know, that at that time there was arranged marriages and she kind of didn't want one, but her father was trying really hard to arrange a marriage and didn't find a husband yet for her, and asked her to pray to Kanan Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion. So she did this day and night during all of her activities. And before long, she experienced an awakening. And one day her father peeked into her room and saw her sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra. "What are you doing sitting on that precious scripture?" he shouted. "How is this wonderful scripture different from my ass?" she replied. "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" She shows her intimacy with the great matter and invites us to treasure within the body, even when It is the disputable and bawdy but. Rebuked for sitting on the sutras, she overthrows the sacred and profane and comes forth with the tender question, how is this wonderful sutra different from my butt? It's great. So we're offered this koan to the great matter of life and death and grieving. And she's such a comfort to me when I read this, that she could be so completely human. Not hiding, weeping and wailing the death of her granddaughter. What an appropriate response, isn't it? And it might not be what we expect from a Dharma story about how to let go of attachment. How is she doing that? What is she helping us get in touch with? So koans ask us to put us into every role and every part of the situation to see what is the consciousness or the awareness, the non-dual aspect that we're to gather from this. So maybe when I was sitting with it, I was picturing Sachijo weeping openly, throwing herself on the ground before her daughter's ash jar, perhaps at the funeral. I see people coming to visit her, not ready for their visit, saying, she's too sad to interact with people. I'm imagining Sachijo making daily trips to her granddaughter's grave, bringing flowers and lingering there with tears just streaming down her face. Is there a difference between her grief and the grief that troubles us so much? The grief that we want to deny and get over with as soon as possible? The grief that knots us up and twists us up inside? Is there? Yes and no. She knows who she is. She's letting in so completely. She's wailing, but she didn't need to be told to stop. She's weeping because something tragic happened. She lost her granddaughter, a beloved child. An old man from the neighborhood came and admonished her. Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll say, the old lady once studied with Hakuin and was enlightened. So now why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up a bit. So we need to be this old man too. We are him. When? Or has it? Or is it? Has it ever been our place to tell someone who is suffering to lighten up? Was this old man trying to alleviate Sachijo's suffering? He seems much more worried to me about her reputation. Maybe it's his own. Maybe we get embarrassed about our own reputation. Is this maintaining a system of oppression? Placing his own unrecognized grief on someone else's body? Is this an act of hatred on display? Is it a blemish on his own image? Rearranging his projection of a Zen person, the expression of discomfort of being in his own vulnerability. We don't know for sure. This is where it took when I was him. I can imagine all these, why that response? You're enlightened. Why are you mourning so much? You ought to lighten up a bit. And her response shows her complete presence of mind, doesn't it? her cutting clarity. She snaps out of her wailing and glares at the old man. Bald-headed fool. What do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than this incense, flowers, and lamp. And lamps. Sometimes that is helpful, and sometimes it is not. She breaks it all up with her wisdom of her anger and rage and uses it skillfully. She shows we can practice grief in accord with its nature, and when we do, it's liberated. Her grief is liberated. So the Dharma teaches us how to be present to grief. Zazen is where we can be quiet and enter our innermost chamber. In Zazen, we are present to our breath. We sit noticing our thoughts and our feelings, and as they arise, letting them go, letting them just move on and returning. And then we see when we feel ripping sorrow, we stay with it, feeling it deeply, being curious about it. As we stay present to sorrow, we can also stay present to lack of sorrow. This happens too. Grief can include anger, joy, guilt, depression, tears, loneliness, comfort, or nothing at all. The Dharma teaches us that everything arises and falls away. And so we have each found our way to our Bodhi seat to examine our mind in our body. Urging us always to move towards accepting. And sometimes our losses touch our loss of power, control, boundaries, self-image, trust, more. So to just sit and observe without judging is a powerful way to care for ourselves as we grieve. Just sitting and observing, moving, painting, walking, feeling the air and the wind is a way to care for ourselves as we grieve. And when we do that, we begin to sit in a place of acceptance even before we're ready to accept our loss. We place ourselves into that path of acceptance even before we're ready. Can we trust this? Grieving shouldn't be rushed or hidden. It can't be, and don't ever allow anyone to tell you so or how you're going to be at the end of it. Fine. Or whatever. Gosh, I remember how irritating that was. Oh, when you get through this, well, I'm not. Don't take me there. I'm still in it. Don't take me to the other side. I haven't gone there yet. And how do you know? That's up to me, right? How I'm going to release and see the nature of myself and integrate Dharma into this, who I truly am at the base. We grieve because we want to get back to our heart, which has no language. So it's important to sometimes not give it that, not call it anything. Accept the cycle. This is the Dharma of how to be present to grief in its beauty, pain, and complexity. The way to heal, the way to live it. And I know, as I said, there's this feeling of a kind of dissolve. If we dissolve into that, if we dissolve into that letting, will I still be me? will I disappear or go mad? Just don't leave yourself. Don't leave the searing sensations, as Sachido showed us. We do not disappear. We do not disappear only into the sensation. Nor do we drown, though it feels like you may hear sounds coming out of you that you just never experienced before as you wail. And neither do we cry forever. But from time to time, these tears are called from us, and then they're no longer frightening. Tears are a small ceremony to keep us close to ourselves and to the world. The salty remnants of our oceanic beginnings. We weep because something is pouring in and overflowing. And because it's impossible to say anything in moments, it's equally impossible not to offer something back. I've spoke about this before, but it came up again in one of D.T. Suzuki's. You remember D.T.? You all know D.T. Suzuki, the early writer of Zen who came to America. And there's a story about someone meets him and asks, after you're enlightened, do you suffer anymore? After you're enlightened, do you suffer anymore? And D.T. Suzuki said, oh, yes. Yes, you do. And the person said, well, have you suffered? And D.T. Suzuki said, yes, many times. And recently, when my wife died, I cried bitter, bitter tears. And the person replied, well, then what's the point of practice? And D.T. Suzuki said, oh, my tears have no roots. My tears have no roots. I cry a lot. There's a lot to cry about. Are there roots in my tears? Sometimes, yeah. And through practice, I can see that. I can cry deeply, and I can honor every watery drop as my pleasure to release and let go to what is. Like my teacher, Daito Roshi, said, we need to understand rootlessness itself. Rootless means the roots are gone. They're either cut off or undeveloped. When used in terms of people, rootless means that they have no close ties, no connections. Well, what kind of thing has no connections to anything? Is that what the Dharma is about? All dharmas are nothing but rootless. They're not connected to anything, but contain everything. Do you understand? Do you understand? Not in your head, because it's easy enough to understand intellectually. But do you understand in your body? That being the case, where do all these boundaries come from? Where do I end and you begin? What creates these edges? It's got to do with our mind and how we use it, how you see yourself and how you see the universe. Like Sachujo, her tears, fully, fully pregnant with tears, with no source, it just becomes a solvent for what is unyielding within. Tears soften, unstick, topple, and fill and spill. They run like water under ice. And suddenly, what was frozen is flowing again. She was able to do this not because she found a way around her grief, but because she went quiet inside. Grief spoke and asked to be released, unhindered by thought. So, you? You? Your tears? What are your tears? Do we cling to some root, some source, some truth about our tears? Or are they just tears? Just tears. Just crying. Just weeping. No words. Just. My tears have no roots. Grief has no roots. No stories. No blame. They're just my tears. They're just your tears. They're just your complete freedom. Good grief. Good grief. Thank you. Thank you for listening and being in this ceremony. And I hope that you can do that alone through your practice and find others who will let you be, will just be by your side and let it pour out. And this great mother that we're on, she knows how to do that. She can take it all. Just fall to her. Let her hold your body. Let her hold your whale. I mean, earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanoes, what hasn't she opened up and cracked open to? She can hold all our tears. And you and me are not separate from this earth. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC.